Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, and welcome to the PreparedX Podcast. Just before I get started, I'd like to let you know about Group Doulis. Group Doulis centralizes team coordination during incidents, harmonizing procedures across your organization. Go to groupdoulis.com. It's a great app, a great tool for organizations to help their crisis teams start to manage events and see those events through to the end. Great, powerful tool that is available at groupdoulis.com. Okay, so in this podcast, which is now episode 52, I interviewed David Carlson. He's a crisis communication associate of ours here at PreparedX, and he's also a principal of Carlson Communications. My discussion today with David focused on crisis communications, planning, and response. He touched on the importance of exercises at the end of the interview. During the interview, David spoke about his experience with planning for crises. He spoke about social media, which is obviously big. And then he spoke about some recent examples, which you should, which you'll hear during the podcast, some great recent examples of crises and how organizations didn't do so well and some organizations that did a better job. So anyway, I think you'll find that information really interesting. Anyway, enough of me. Here is episode 52 of my interview with David Carlson. Good morning, David, and welcome to the PreparedX podcast for the second time.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be back on the podcast after, I believe, it's been about 3 years. So
yeah,
happy to be back.
Yeah, we were quite surprised that it's been that long because it doesn't feel like it's been that long. Episode 4, I believe. So for our listeners, if you'd like to hear more of David, go back to episode 4. Do the search in the PreparedX website and you'll find my previous interview with David. David, just before we get started, if you could remind our audience a little bit about yourself and your career to date, please.
Sure. Well, I've been a lifelong communications guy with a specialty in crisis communications. I'm a communications associate with PreparedX, and I have my own company, Carlson Communications, for the last 4 or 5 years or so. Mostly, my career has been with public relations agencies, within their crisis communications component.
Sure. Well, appreciate that. Let's start off with discussing how organizations should start. If they've not started already, and as you experience and we often experience in our, in PreparedX and our other businesses, organizations, really are looking for, that foundation piece. How do they, start to develop that crisis communications capability within their organizations?
Yes. Well, before putting pen to paper for any kind of crisis plan, I think there's a couple of conditions that should exist within the organization. And if they don't, they should be put in place as soon as possible. And the first thing is to have a culture of crisis awareness within the organization. This has to come really from the top down and permeate throughout the supervisors all the way to the front lines and empower the employees to be the eyes and ears of the organization. They're your early warning system. They need to know their role as part of this early warning system, know to report incidences that they think could develop into a crisis, or if it's an immediate crisis, to know how to react to that and report when there's time to report. But it has to be a culture of crisis awareness within the organization. That's number one. The second thing is, and this is really up to the communications team to support it, it's nurturing the organization's brand. You see time and time again, if you look at crises in the news, that companies that have strong brands are better able to withstand a crisis, have the crisis end faster, and be put in, relegated to the past faster. If an organization has a weak brand, they're going to be continuously attacked maybe long after the immediate crisis is over. So having a strong brand is very, very important because it's like a suit of armor when you have a crisis. It protects you because when you have a strong brand, you have strong supporters, customers, shareholders, the media, government regulations, and most important, your employees support you. So that's why strong brands always withstand crises much better than weak brands.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. So you mentioned at the beginning of your response there before putting pen to paper, but let's say now they need to start to put pen to paper. Let's talk a little bit about the crisis communications plan and what kind of information mm-hmm. is essential within the plan.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's an intrinsic part of the overall crisis management plan. So you'll have an operational side of the plan, who's going to put out a fire. But it has to be in lock, communications have to be in lockstep with the operational side of things so that they are able to communicate to the employees, to outside audiences, is the fire out? Were people injured? Why did the fire occur? Have you taken steps so that the possibility for the fire won't happen again? These are the kinds of questions that will come up while the fire is being fought on the operational side and even long after it's over. So the communications plan has to be part and parcel of the overall plan. Sometimes it's a separate plan. Sometimes it's within the larger plan. I've seen organizations do it both ways. So, the person tasked with writing the communications side of the plan really has to start with some interviews of mostly people within the C-suite, but you would want to try to interview people at all levels of the company. And this way, you get an idea of what are the vulnerabilities of the organization that need to be thought about and planned for in the communications part of the plan. So if people are worried, say, that about a cyber attack, maybe it's happened already, or there's been some indication that it could happen, they've got to really think about that particular scenario as a subset of a generic communications plan, where they really have documents developed and things like that to address issues such as customer data loss or things like that that would be associated with a cyber attack. And other organizations are going to have all different kinds of things keeping the people in the C-suite up at night. And you want to find out what those vulnerabilities are. Sometimes you can reduce them completely or even eliminate them just by the process of doing the communication plan. Right. But the interviews that identify these vulnerabilities is probably the first step.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was on a call yesterday and with a client, and you know, she made reference to going through it. We're designing an exercise for this client, and you know, we asked a few questions with regards to certain aspects of I think it was cyber response. And she actually, you know, going through this process, actually found out things that she was unaware of, that she should have been aware of. But, you know, it was allowed her to go and ask more questions and really understand more about their response capabilities and actions. Mm. So, you know, just walking through the plan and discussing it, sitting down and you know, questioning it from different angles certainly is beneficial. Mm-hmm. So that's great information. Mm-hmm.
So, but there are several other things. If I may, just sure. There are several other things that are essential in the crisis communications plan that will also inform the overall crisis communications team. You need a way to gauge the severity of the incident that's at hand. I mean, you want to distinguish: is it an issue or is it a crisis?
Right.
An issue can be managed over time, and it could turn into a crisis. But it's important to make that distinction that you don't treat an issue that could be managed over time as a crisis, because you would be putting a disproportionate amount of resources and effort into something that really would not necessitate even the convening of the crisis team if it is judged to be an issue. Now, if it is judged to be a crisis, you also want to judge the severity of the crisis. Is it, you know, condition yellow, condition orange, condition red, being the most serious type of crisis? And each organization will have different criteria as to, you know, what makes it a yellow or an orange or a red crisis in severity. And the reason you want to have this yardstick or thermometer of the crisis is so, again, you have a proportional response. You don't want to under-respond to a crisis because that'll actually worsen the crisis, as will over-responding to a crisis because you might be, you know, giving undue attention to a smaller crisis that really was not really warranted. For example, if you have a facility in Idaho, but your headquarters are in New York and there's a crisis in Idaho, maybe it could be handled in Idaho. You don't want to start, you know, fly the CEO in necessarily, you know, from New York headquarters and bring undue attention to it if it's not necessary. If the situation in Idaho is serious enough that it warrants that, then okay, do it. But you want to make sure that your response is proportional to the severity.
Sure. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Excuse me. So this often comes up in discussions with those that are responsible for planning the response to an event. And it's the social media component. So, you know, do you see many social media specific crisis plans to deal with social media, or is it, you know, a subset of the crisis communications plan? And also, can you touch on some of the pros and cons of social media during a crisis?
Sure. In my opinion, I think that every social media is part and parcel of any communications crisis plan because you cannot separate social media anymore from traditional media. Even if something appears, let's say, in the Wall Street Journal, it's going to be online. There's going to be comments about it. It's going to be tweeted. It's going to be show up in groups on LinkedIn and things like that. It's going to be social automatically. So they are almost, in my view, one and the same now. I don't see how you can separate them, at least easily. Maybe somebody can tell me how to separate them, but I don't think you can. So you would think that a communications team already has monitoring in place of both traditional and social media, and they might have to step that up during a crisis. Unfortunately, the downside of social media is it can sort of falsely precipitate a crisis. If there's some kind of, let's say, a conspiracy theory involving the organization that's completely untrue, we all know that there are social media avenues for the conspiracy theory to take on a life of itself and then grow so large that it becomes a crisis for the company, even though it's completely not an actual fact. If you do have an actual fact crisis, social media is a tool that can be used as part of the communications support, the communications to external audiences during the crisis. You also have to consider the fact that your employees are all using social media, and you want to have a policy in effect well in advance of any kind of crisis of how your organization wants to regulate employee use of social media.
Sure.
Some companies are at opposite ends of the spectrum on this. I see companies that allow their employees to say anything they want on social media and are very liberal with their, if there are any regulations at all. And other companies are very strict about not having the employee say anything about their work using social media. So it's all over the place. It has to be tailor-made to the organization and what the policy is. But every organization should have a social media policy for employees. It's a double-edged sword. I always say that. It can work for the good of the company. It can work for the detriment of the company, social media.
Sure. And we see that, don't we? We see that often. And I guess, you know, moving on to the next question, this may kind of dovetail into this question with regard to, you know, recent crises where organizations have found it difficult to manage incidents. You probably mentioned a few back in 2015 during our last interview. So it's been a number of years since then. Have there been recent crises where organizations have found it difficult? And maybe there's other examples of, you know, those organizations that have also communicated well during a crisis?
Sure. Well, it's very interesting that the last time I was on this podcast was 3 years ago, because I suspect I spoke about Chipotle at the time, because in 2015, they had a foodborne illness problem where customers in several states succumbed to something called a neurovirus that was is a foodborne illness.
Right.
And they had tremendous problem crisis. It was a terrible crisis. Their stock tumbled like 35%. And it's still down there in part because of that 3 years ago crisis. But just recently, there was another outbreak of some other foodborne illness in Ohio. This is maybe a week or so ago. And they've been slow to respond to their customers, worsening an already compromised trust problem that they have. This is an example of where communications failed, not because the communications are bad, but because the operational side was not able and hasn't been able in Chipotle to get a handle on why they're having these foodborne illness problems 3 years running.
Sure.
So that's an example of a company that that's in really still a terrible crisis. The original CEO stepped down. They have a new CEO since the spring, and he finds himself with his hands full. We see today, this is very interesting. I think maybe a couple months ago, Nike had a problem of sexual harassment and sexual problems with the women executives not being promoted, not being paid as much as men, plus out and out sexual harassment. And it's compromising for the company in part because one of their biggest targets are women. So this is something that's been dogging them. And if you go to the Nike website, it's kind of in a way worse than when you see about Nike, and I'm quoting now because I just did this morning. It says, "Our mission is what drives us to do everything possible to expand human potential." Well, there's plenty of evidence that they were not able to do that with some of their top women executives who have filed all kinds of lawsuits against the company. So they have that those lawsuits as a problem, but I think they also have a problem. This is the first thing about Nike that they say, to do everything possible to expand human potential. You see that a lot with companies that have sort of, lack of a better term, highfalutin values that they're prominent on their website, and they are then involved with a crisis where it just undermines all those values, and it, I think it worsens the communications challenge to have that kind of disconnect between what they're saying about their values and what the substance of the crisis is.
Sure.
Now, a good example, I think that also this is how powerful social media can help feed a crisis. We all know what happened with the racial incident in Starbucks in Philadelphia. And that was an egregious crisis for the company. The video of racist behavior went viral. And the response, I thought, was very good. I mean, they basically shut down their stores for one day in a well-announced move. And they announced their intention to train all their employees for racial sensitivity and things like that. I thought that was an effective response. And again, Starbucks is an example of a very strong brand with very strong customer support and even more important, employee support. And I think that those have been huge factors in their being able to get over that crisis quickly. A sort of a mixed bag that's happening right now is what's going on with CBS, with Les Moonves, their CEO, being accused by six women of sexual misconduct.
Right.
It was a big article in the New Yorker last month, written by Ronan Farrow, who was, of course, the guy who broke all the Harvey Weinstein stuff. So it's powerful stuff in the New Yorker magazine. And CBS board has decided to hire outside legal counsel to investigate, which is fine. That's appropriate. However, I said it was a mixed bag. I'm seeing articles that CBS is facing a credibility problem because the chosen law firms to do the investigation have had previous very strong ties to the network. Where they had been advocates for the network.
Right.
So now they're investigating their client after working for the client as an advocate. So
sure, the results will be fine.
It's kind of a, yeah, so we're going to watch what happens with that one.
Right, very interesting, and current. So we, again, appreciate your comments there. So as we start to wrap this up, as you know, and you're involved in several of these throughout the year, and that's crisis simulation exercises. Just before, could you touch on the importance of these, and obviously you can reference the communication element of that, and why it's important to include all relevant internal stakeholders in these crisis drills?
Sure. Well, exercises enable the organization to assess and improve its crisis plan and the performance of its crisis management team. It's that simple. Organizations that have a crisis plan sitting on a shelf and never having tested it or never having tested their team will be testing it during an actual crisis. I don't think you want to be in that position. So it just makes absolute logical sense that you want to have a tested plan and a tested response team. And there's a huge percentage of organizations that just don't do it, probably for budget considerations or it's other priorities push it out of the way. But it's just a mistake. And to me, it's just an obvious logical mistake, but there it is.
Sure. Well, this has been, it's been too long, I guess.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rob. I wanted to answer the second part of your question about all stakeholders being involved in these exercises. It is inevitable in some certain kinds of crises, so let's say an active shooter, where the organization is going to be working to manage the crisis and manage the communications with other agencies. In this case would be law enforcement. So when you're conducting the exercise, you would want to invite your local law enforcement and have them participate as well. This way, you could ensure that they're familiar with your, say, buildings, your facility's floor plans and exits and things like that, that would be important for them to know about if there were to be such a horrendous issue like an active shooter. So exercises held jointly with first responders and things like that and other agencies is an important step.
Sure. Yeah, we often see that coming. Certainly, if an organization has not done many of these before, they get a little bit nervous about bringing regulators in and other, government stakeholders for the first exercise because they often feel less prepared. So they like to go through that step first. And then, the second year, they feel a little bit more advanced, or the next exercise, they feel more comfortable. But I don't think there's anything bad about bringing them in sooner rather than later. It shows that you're open to them being exposed to your plans and your processes. So I think it's only a positive. But what I will say, what we see, David, is coming up with that stakeholder list as part of your planning process. So not even before you get into the exercise, but trying to understand who the critical stakeholders are. Again, could be scenario based, but often these exercises lead into conversations around, well, actually, I would need to reach out to the FBI, it's a cyber event, or there's obviously a very cyber specific agencies that you'd have to communicate with, and again, local fire response, EMS, police, as it relates to public safety emergencies, those types of things. But having those relationships built ahead of time and having that stakeholder list available to you is certainly something that should be planned well ahead of time.
Totally agree, and that stakeholder list is part of any crisis communications plan. I totally agree with you, Rob.
Sure. Okay, great. Well, let's not leave it 3 years next time, David. This has been great, great discussion as always.
There'll be other examples down the road.
I'm sure there will.
Good and bad.
Yeah, we'll turn on the Sunday evening news, and there'll be something bubbling for Monday morning for sure. David, any final comments, and where can the listeners get a hold of you?
Sure. Well, you can always get a hold of me through PreparedX website. I think my contact information is on there, yep. Or feel free to email me at david.cowson@preparedx.com.
Okay.
As far as final comments go, I'm just trying to think about what's next in crisis communication. We know, obviously, about the role of the internet. Maybe it'll come down to something having to do with blockchain, not so much as a platform for crisis management, distributed networks and things like that. I can't predict. Maybe 3 years from now, in the next podcast, we'll be talking about blockchains as part of your crisis plan.
Yeah. Always like to try and think ahead. So that's good. Okay, David. Well, again, thanks for your time today, and we'll be in touch. Have a nice weekend. Well, that wraps up our 52nd podcast. If you did enjoy this podcast, please rate us on iTunes and anywhere else you're listening to this, the other podcast outlets, please rate us. Also, leave a comment if you're listening to it through our website, this podcast. Please leave a comment because we like your feedback. And again, thank you for listening today, and I hope you have a safe and productive day. Thank you.